I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Hundreds of Florida high school students, many wearing We Call BS t-shirts, rallied in Tallahassee yesterday at the state capitol, demanding that lawmakers curb the sale of assault rifles. This was a week after a gunman using an AR-15 killed 17 students and teachers at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Here's a montage of some of those speakers from the Washington Post.
Mr. President, what do I tell my mother? What do I tell her if she asks if I will return home today? What do I tell my brother if he asks if he's safe at school? Do I lie? Mr. President, how much is my life worth?
Millions have lost faith in their government, but all that means is that we lost faith in ourselves. I am here for those voices that are raised but drowned out by greed. I am here for the soundless in all of America.
But as long as our voices are heard, as long as everyone here stands up to the tyranny that's occurring in our legislative bodies, democracy will never die and change will occur.
Yeah. Well, members of the legislature, I am proud to announce I took your advice. I have been praying. I have been praying for you. And should you continue to choose your wallets over our lives, I pray you enjoy retirement. Because we will vote you out.
It's just very unfair for politicians to take money from the NRA, to lie to us and tell them that they love us as children and that they care about us, and they lie through their teeth, and they tell us that they want to see change too, that they want us to be safe. They care about our safety. They don't care about us. I promise you they don't. If they cared about us, we would be having change.
This is just the latest mass shooting that has shocked and numbed the nation, but could this moment be different? The White House held an emotional listening session yesterday with school shooting survivors and families of shooting victims. Last night, CNN hosted a town hall where students, teachers, and parents confronted Senator Marco Rubio and NRA spokeswoman Dana Loesch. We will play clips from those events during our show today. Well, today on the show, what can be done to reduce the epidemic of gun violence, whether mass shootings or the daily incidents of gunshot deaths and injuries that happen all too frequently in places like Philadelphia and Baltimore? Joining us and here in our Philadelphia studio is Scott Charles. He's Temple University Hospital's Trauma Outreach Coordinator, where he directs the Cradle to Grave program, working with high school and middle school students here in Philadelphia. Scott Charles, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. And joining us by telephone from Baltimore is Cassandra Kerfasi. She's assistant professor at the Center for Gun Policy and Research in the Department of Health Policy and Management at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Cassandra Kerfasi, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much.
Scott, if I can begin with you. You have been on the show before talking about gun violence and children, both as victims but also as shooters as well. Yesterday seems like an extraordinary day. We heard a clip of some of those young people talking about what happened in their school and how it has affected them. We heard people telling really painful stories at the White House. We heard others angrily confronting Rubio and the NRA spokeswoman. Does this feel like a special pivotal moment to you? Or is it too soon to tell?
You know, I think it's too soon to tell the long term effects of this moment, whether or not it's ultimately going to bear fruit. If I were a betting person, I would suggest that it will ultimately bear fruit. I think that this represents a turning point, and I think it has everything to do with who the victims were this time. I think it has to do with the fact that it's a tipping point. This is the cumulative effect of years and years of young people being massacred in their schools. And when you look at the movement that didn't just occur in Florida, but the way that it seemed to spark other walkouts in different parts of the country, I think it has a lot to do with the way that young people are kind of able to catalyze their voices and turn it into action.
You're not jaded like I think a lot of people who feel just that nothing is going to happen. This is America.
Yeah,
we have to learn to live with it.
And I think that they can't afford to be jaded when you think about the fact that they just watched a number of their classmates be murdered. And so I think that this is why, unlike some of the massacres that we've seen in the past, that this truly could be a pivotal moment.
How do you see it, Cass?
I agree. I think in my experience in following gun violence generally and mass shootings, this feels different to me. I agree we can't sort of see what the long-term outcomes will be, but I feel like the conversations are different. People are engaged in a different way, both young people sort of being more actively engaged and the general population. And we're starting to see changes in how policymakers are talking about this. We're hearing them at least acknowledge that they should consider things that they had previously been opposed to. So I feel all of this together is sort of resulting in a slightly different reaction, and I'm hoping it results in some action that will be seen at Congress.
Let me play a clip from last night's CNN town hall on guns. And this is a man named Fred Gutenberg, a father of a casualty, a student who died at the Parkland High School. And he's asking a question of Senator Marco Rubio.
My daughter running down the hallway at Marjorie Stoneman yes, Douglas was shot in the back.
Yes, sir.
With an assault weapon. The weapon of choice.
Yes, sir.
Okay? It is too easy to get. It is a weapon of war. The fact that you can't stand with everybody in this building and say that, I'm sorry.
Sir, I do believe what you're saying is true.
Scott, are assault weapons the problem? They were certainly used at Sandy Hook, also in Las Vegas and some other mass shootings as well, and also used at this school.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to argue that assault weapons alone are the problem when you consider the amount of gun violence that we have in America and how rare it is for assault weapons to be used in homicides nationally. In these types of homicides, in mass shootings, they are certainly the weapon of choice. And you will have people who would argue that if it weren't an AR-15 or an AK-47, the perpetrator would find some other means. The truth, however, is that there really aren't many weapons that are out there on the market that allow an individual to kill so many people in so quickly, but with such devastating impact. That really is the value, I hate to use that term,
right,
but it is really the power of the AR-15 is its ability to send a bullet at such a high rate of speed, at such velocity into the human body, and the injuries that it creates are devastating.
Well, and I should say to our listeners and to our other guests, you have an
AR-15. Yeah,
you bought one.
Yeah.
You go to a target range and you shoot it.
Yeah, absolutely.
What was it like to buy an AR-15? How hard was that?
It was surprisingly easy. It was something that was purchased for me as a gift, and I picked it up from a licensed dealer, a place where I shoot, from great people. But the process is surprisingly easy when you consider who's able to get their hands on one. There was no questions about my experience using it, although it was certainly at a range where I've used a weapon before. But there was no kind of system to check, how skilled I was at using it or what my past history was or any of those things. And I think that's one of the things that we're going to have to address as a society, this balance of having gun rights, but also making sure that those gun rights are used by the right people.
I guess I'd love to hear your response to that. And I should say to our listeners, we invited both of our guests on because while they are dedicated to reducing the level of gun violence and focused on gun safety, they also are gun owners, which I think gives them a certain kind of experience that a lot of people don't have. I'd just be curious, Cass, your thoughts about, is it too easy to get a gun or perhaps a long gun or an AR in this country?
Sure. So first, I want to circle back to the comment about assault rifles and mass shootings. And we do see in research that assault rifles are being more commonly used in mass shootings as time is going on. And not only that, we're seeing more casualties in these mass shootings because, as Scott said, we're seeing, large capacity magazines. You can shoot more people and sort of cause more devastating damage. So I think that some of that is bearing out in the research. I do think that it is too easy to get assault rifles or, if you want to call them modern sporting rifles, you can. It doesn't undergo the same process, for example, if you're going to buy a handgun. It's, you have to be 21 to buy a handgun. And while handguns are more commonly used in crime and the sort of day-to-day violence that we see, the assault rifles are so devastating that it sort of bears the question, why are the standards not the same for an assault rifle as they are for a handgun?
And that's one of the things that was called for, as I listened to people speaking both at the White House and also at this town forum. And we should say that the alleged shooter, a young person named Nicholas Cruz, had an AR-15. Apparently, Scott, he bought it legally.
Yeah,
he was old enough to buy it.
Yeah, and you know, I think that there were so many warning signs in his life that should have represented red flags, but didn't, because there really is no system in place to say, you know, And I hate to put the pressure on the gun dealer, because the gun dealer is, you know, does what is required of him or her. But, you know, the gun dealer ran the background check. He came up clear to get it. So who then is there to kind of step in and say, well, given the fact that he's been expelled from school for violent behavior, given his disturbing postings online, is this really the right person to own this kind of gun, especially when so many people instantly thought, I think this Nick guy is probably the guy who did something like this.
These are some of the students.
Some of the students said he seemed most capable of doing something like this.
Yes, there is something called red flag laws. And I should add something to what Scott said. And apparently the police had been called to his house where he lived with his stepmother numerous times. And it does raise questions about how a troubled young man could get his hand on such a powerful weapon.
Yeah, we in public health and gun violence prevention, we talk about gun violence restraining orders or extreme risk protection orders, which really are a mechanism when someone identifies a quote-unquote red flag and is concerned about a gun owner harming themselves or others. There's this mechanism in place. Connecticut and Indiana have a law where law enforcement can petition to get these guns temporarily taken away. And in Washington, Oregon, and California, they expand that to family members and friends and a little bit broader population who may have experience with the individual and can see that the person is at risk. And I think, you know, people often talk about Second Amendment rights and their ability to sort of exercise that right as a law-abiding citizen. And I don't think that extreme risk protection orders go against that right. This is nothing, it says nothing about sort of broad legal gun ownership. It's individual specific risk. It's this person is identified as being a potential threat to themselves or others. And it's a temporary situation with due process, exactly the same kind of process for a domestic violence restraining order. So the person can have their day in court. They can present, you know, evidence saying that they are fine. But I think that this situation in Florida could have been prevented with an extreme risk protection order.
I do want to pick up on that and take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Cassandra Cafasi, also with us, Scott Charles. We're talking about the gun rampage last week in Florida and where we go from here. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Scott Charles. He's Temple University Hospital's Trauma Outreach Coordinator, where he directs the Cradle to Grave program, working with high school students and middle school students here in Philadelphia. And joining us by telephone is Cassandra Cafasi. She's Assistant Professor at the Center for Gun Policy and Research in the Department of Health Policy and Management at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. That is in Baltimore, Maryland. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. The question being, where do we go from here? Let me play another clip from last night's CNN town hall meeting on guns. And this is student survivor Cameron Caskey asking a question of Senator Marco Rubio.
Senator Rubio, can you tell me right now that you will not accept a single donation from the NRA in the future?
The influence of these groups comes not from money. The influence comes from the millions of people that agree with the agenda. So the millions of Americans that support the NRA and who
all
support
right.
gun rights.
Sorry, Senator. Guys.
The NRA. I mean, Scott, we have spent whole hours talking about the NRA on this program, but I wonder, with this this horrible rampage and massacre that happened last week, the NRA has been relatively quiet. I don't know if that's unusual for them. Are they How much are they the problem?
Well, I think when you look at any group that holds that much sway over politicians and that, you know, seems to wholeheartedly reject sensible gun legislation, it becomes somewhat problematic. And it's not surprising that in the wake of this shooting, when you have so many vocal young people out there, that they were aware of kind of the wave that was occurring. They've since kind of resurfaced on social media. But I think that this moment, when you see so many young people calling out politicians and saying, we're no longer going to allow you to accept money, at our risk, you're going to potentially see some significant change.
How do you see it, Cass?
So I feel that I partly agree with what Senator Rubio said in that it's not just about money. So one of the strengths of the NRA is its ability to activate its base to go out and vote, to write letters, to sort of be single-issue voters that can influence who is or is not in office. And so part of it is how they use that money to target for or against different individuals. But it's also this activation that sometimes we lack on the sort of gun policy and gun violence prevention side. It is a huge sort of David and Goliath sort of situation. How can we compete against that? But I feel, as I said earlier, that there's a shift now in where who's paying attention and who's going to be activated in the 2018 election. And so I'm hoping that maybe some of the sort of powerful influence of the NRA can be deteriorated.
Well, and I want to pick up on something that Scott and I mentioned during the break, but going back to this young man who is the accused shooter in this case, the FBI was actually called in February. Someone was concerned about him and wanted to notify them that this was someone that they should not just keep an eye on, but I guess go and talk to. And apparently it did not happen, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, this is an obvious error on their part, a huge opportunity that was missed. And I think they've acknowledged that. But I think that we've got to have as many backups as possible. We can no longer, look at the situation and say it's, this is the cause or this is the cause. We've got to do better about tightening the current system. And, we have to decide, what we care most about. Do we care most about our children or do we care most about our affection for firearms?
Let me see what Greg, looks like Greg from Princeton Junction has to say. And Greg, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
My question was this. I believe there was a ban on assault weapons for about 10 years during the Clinton administration. I have two questions. Why was it ever lifted? And did we actually show that we've reduced gun violence, at least with the use of assault weapons during that time? And I'll take my answer offline.
Sure. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Cass, can you take that?
Sure. So the ban was allowed to lapse in 2004, so it wasn't that anyone voted to sort of take it away. It just had an expiration date, and it wasn't voted back into law. And there are sort of mixed thoughts about whether it was effective for a couple of reasons. As we talked about earlier, assault weapons are not the sort of weapon of choice for commonly committed crimes. Handguns are far more concealable and are used more in day-to-day violence. But there were also a lot of exceptions for what could or did not constitute as an assault rifle. So manufacturers were very savvy and able to make some very minor modifications that, maybe it only had 6 of the 7 criteria and so then was no longer considered an assault rifle. So there were ways to get around it. I think it didn't have a general effect on crime during that time, but we're seeing now with increased ease of access to these firearms, again, they're being used far more commonly to commit mass shootings.
Let me play one more clip from that town meeting. And again, this is Senator Marco Rubio, and he is speaking, addressing this question about these assault rifles and what he calls the loopholes.
It's not the loopholes. It's the problem that once you start looking at how easy it is to get around it, you would literally have to ban every semi-automatic rifle that's sold in America.
And Scott, there is a call. I mean, you hear it. People want to ban or ban once again these assault rifles. Does that address the problem?
Well, I think it addresses part of the problem. I think we still have to look at things like you know, how easy people are getting weapons in general. But, you know, to look at, to go back to what Cassandra was saying, this is really becoming kind of the weapon of choice. It's become the weapon of choice. And I think, you know, the devastating injuries that these weapons cause is something that we have to look at. You know, I saw, I kind
you,
of...
And you have looked at them.
Yeah.
I should say to our...
Yeah, absolutely. I see firsthand what AR-15s and AK-47s do to the human body. And I kind of cringed yesterday when one of the parents during the town hall meeting suggested that, you know, we protect airports and we protect concerts. And I was struck because it occurred to me that the worst mass shooting in American history happened at a concert. And it was only made possible because of the fact that an individual was able to, you know, kind of sit up in a perch in a hotel room looking down on a group of concert goers and was able to use this incredibly powerful weapon to shoot more than 600 people.
I mean, that could be an argument to ban them, but I'm looking at you. You own an
AR-15. Yeah, absolutely. I own an AR-15. And I'm aware of the power that they hold. But I also am very practical about it. One of the things that I was struck by is just the ease with which I was able to purchase that. And, you know, how little kind of background information they had about me when they sold me this weapon. I would probably be among the first people in line if there was a call for a assault weapons ban, because it provides me enjoyment when I shoot at a paper target, but that's about it. Yeah. And given that I see what these weapons do to people, I'm probably one of the last persons that, you know, one of the last people that wants to actually point that weapon at somebody and pull that trigger.
Cassandra, let me turn to you. And in doing some homework for the show today, my understanding is that mass shootings account, this was back a couple of years, in fact, that might be out of date, I'm not sure, 2013, that mass shootings accounted for less than 2% of gun deaths. Of course, it gets so much attention because the number of people that die and get injured in these mass killings, but does it sort of skew the conversation away from the more everyday, regular gun violence that we have, for instance, here in Philly, and I'm sure in Baltimore as well, where you are?
Yeah, so I think the number that we're estimating right now is about 2.5% with the most recent data that's available. So yes, yeah, so still, I think in the grand scheme of things, a small portion, but it's an opportunity to draw people's attention back to the everyday gun violence. We often, you know, talk about policy solutions that could specifically address the mass shooting. Like, for example, here, the Extreme Risk Protection Order in Florida, like all of those instances that came up that triggered to law enforcement that maybe this is someone who needs a temporary ban on gun ownership. But then we try to think about broader policy implications that would affect both these mass shootings, but then also the everyday gun violence. It's far too easy for individuals that are prohibited to avoid undergoing a background check in 32 of our states. They can just buy from a private seller who has no duty to conduct a background check. So I think sometimes we do miss the sort of bigger picture. You know, we have over 36,000 people a year at this point dying from gun violence. And so I don't want to have the 2.5% drive the conversation, but there are overlapping policy implications that could help reduce gun violence overall.
And when you say 36,000, that's both homicides and suicides?
Correct, yes.
Because suicide
is the leading cause of firearm death in the United States.
Scott, looks like you want to say something.
No, and I think we also have to be honest about why America seems so moved by these kinds of shootings. As I've argued in the past, and as I argued after the shooting at the Pulse nightclub, it's easy for America to see her children in those classrooms. But the majority, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Cassandra, but I believe the majority of mass shootings, as defined by the FBI, are actually occurring in cities, and they're occurring on playgrounds and in basketball courts and on street corners. But America doesn't seem to be as persuaded by those shootings because she doesn't see her children in those scenarios. But when it comes to theater shootings or it comes to classroom shootings or college campus shootings, it's easy for America to see her children there. And I think that I'm not suggesting that we disregard these more, you know, these more kind of high profile mass shootings. But we should certainly use them to hopefully drive change that's happening here. But we should also be discussing the more mundane day to day shootings that we're seeing in America.
With the young people that you work with in Philadelphia, what does a gun mean to them?
Well, I mean, a gun means a number of things. It's a double-edged sword. It represents the thing that, in Philadelphia in particular, represents the leading cause of death for young black men in the city. It is more than half the time the cause of death for young black men between the ages of 15 and 24 here. But oftentimes they see that as the only defense that they have and the only source of protection that they have. And many of them are unaware of exactly what it is that these weapons do to one another, because we've kind of sanitized this violence. And so one of the goals that I have is to try to tell them the truth about what it is that these weapons are doing. Because so often, you know, and we're seeing this with regard to Florida, we talk about the deaths, but just as many people will survive those shootings. And in Philadelphia, more than 80% of people who are shot survive. And they survive with devastating long-term injuries.
I know there's this healing hurt people. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of this approach to young people that perhaps have had difficult childhoods or difficult life circumstances, which makes them or puts them, I guess, at risk.
Absolutely.
For being either the victim or the perpetrator of a violent act.
Yeah, absolutely. As they argue, hurt people hurt people.
Right. Let me get Glenn from Vineland, and then, Cass, I'll give you a chance to respond to Glenn's comment. And, Glenn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Always sure. A pleasure.
Thanks.
I would like to say that it starts long before. I mean, I want to say from the beginning, gun control is good. I think it's needed. Tighter controls, I mean, abandonment of all guns. But I'd like to know, we teach our kids from birth, Bruce Willis movies, violent video games. I mean, was that kid have in mind in Florida that he was in the middle of a live video game? And another point I'd like to make.
Well, you know what, Glenn, if you don't mind, let me take that one, because it's one I'm sure a lot of people are wondering, and obviously we can't get in the side of the head of
well,
the.
I just want to connect one more thought with that, and sure. Then I'll take my answer up there. I mean, we want to educate people. I've never seen a public service announcement. I've seen a lot of them about smoking. Never one about gun control or how to handle guns. And thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Glenn, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Cass, you want to respond? Can we point to video games?
So I think the challenge with trying to point to something like a video game is that the United States is not unique in the video games that it has. It's not unique in its, you know, deteriorating family structure or, you know, sort of moral objections people have to the different lives that individuals choose to lead. You know, the main thing that separates the United States from the rest of the world is the number of guns that we own. And so we have to take a holistic approach. We have to focus on education and economic opportunities and, you know, sort of having morally appropriately raised children, but we also need to think about how those children access firearms.
Let me read a comment from Lizzie. She said, please explain why you thought it was important to have gun owners on your program today. Prioritizing their voices over others seems to make the issue about gun rights rather than about public safety. If we want to debate the rights of the Second Amendment actually guarantees, I'm all for that. But in your current discussion, there is an assumption that there is an unquestionable, unalienable right that we all have to work around to ensure safety. To borrow a phrase from a real hero of the moment, we call that BS. I have lost count of the number of programs that we have done about guns and gun violence and gun safety and gun control, however you want to frame it. We always end up at the same place. I saved all my intros over the last 15 years. They are all the same. We are looking for a different conversation today. And these are two people, yes, they own guns, but they are all about gun safety and reducing gun violence. And I think we have talked with people who want to take away guns. Frankly, I don't think that's going to happen in the United States of America. Scott?
Well, I think you're certainly doing something right, because if you spend any time in my Twitter feed, you'll see that I'm, you know, most often called a gun grabber, you know, somebody who wants to take away somebody's guns.
It's not going to happen. Is it? We have 200 million guns in this country, or even more than that.
Yeah, we have more than that, more than 300 million guns. But the truth is that that's not going to happen. And I would hate for anybody to walk away from this conversation thinking that I was here to blindly defend the rights of people to possess guns and to use them in any way that they wish. You know, I'm going to be the first person who would argue that, you know, you have a right to own a gun, but it really should not be this easy.
Well, and I know, Cass, from reading a little bit about you, you go on a regular basis to the shooting range so that you can stay current and stay I guess safe with your firearms.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to comment also, being at the you know, Bloomberg School of Public Health and the association there with Michael Bloomberg, and I am always immediately assumed to be a gun grabber, much like Scott. Like, people assume that I want to take everyone's guns away and that no one should have them. I think there's a difference between understanding the Constitution as currently interpreted confers on individuals a right to have guns in the home for self-defense versus promoting that, like, everyone should have guns everywhere all the time. I think Scott and I would agree that there are reasonable restrictions on who can own guns and perhaps even what kinds of guns or what kinds of accessories, and sort of having laws with teeth to make sure those things don't happen.
Absolutely.
But I think we often miss the moderate voice of a gun owner, right? We hear people who want to take everyone's guns away, or everyone who, you know, says we should all have guns all the time. And this very large percent of the population who is a gun owner who supports these legislations, like myself and like Scott, we get missed. So I very much appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Well, we're happy to have you as well. Don't go away. We're just going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with Cassandra Cafisi and Scott Charles. We're talking about what to do about guns, gun safety, however you define it. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about the epidemic of gun violence in America, why the problem seems so intractable, and what policies have proved to be effective in stemming gun deaths. And again, joining us, Cassandra Cafisi, joining us from Baltimore, Maryland, assistant professor at the Center for Gun Policy and Research in the Department of Health Policy and Management at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Scott Charles with us here in our Philadelphia studio, and he is Temple University Hospital's Trauma Outreach Coordinator. He directs the Cradle to Grave program, working with middle schoolers and high schoolers about how to prevent gun violence and violence in the city of Philadelphia. Let me play some more clips. And these are some folks that were at the White House yesterday. The president, the vice president, and the education secretary were there. It was described as a listening session. This is the father of a casualty of the Parkland shooting, a man named Andrew Pollack, speaking to the president on Wednesday. Let's give it a listen.
It doesn't make sense. Fix it. Should have been one school shooting, and we should have fixed it. And I'm pissed because my daughter I'm not going to see again. She's not here. She's not here. She's at in North Lauderdale at whatever it is, King David Cemetery. That's where I go to see my kid now.
So sad. This is a student survivor of the Parkland shooting, a young man named Samuel Zeef, and he's speaking to the president of the White House yesterday.
How is it that easy to buy this type of weapon? How do we not stop this after Columbine, after Sandy Hook? I'm sitting with a mother that lost her son. It's still happening.
And she was sitting next to the mother of one of the children who was shot more than 5 years ago at Sandy Hook. Cassandra, so what policies, what programs, what interventions would reduce gun violence in America?
So we see some very effective strategies when we require prospective purchasers of handguns to obtain a permit. So currently, if you go into a licensed gun dealer in the majority of states, they do a federal background check. You know, you may have a waiting period, but it's that background check is dependent upon federal records. If it doesn't come back in 3 days, the default is to proceed with the sale, and then it's sort of up to the ATF to determine if they need to go take the gun away from you. But in 10 states, including Maryland, You have to get a permit. You apply at local law enforcement. They have at a minimum 30 days to conduct a more thorough background check that can identify prohibiting conditions. You submit fingerprints. You have your picture taken, and it sort of holds gun purchasers a little bit more accountable. Licensed sellers and private sellers can only sell to someone who has a permit. And we see significant reductions in firearm homicide in states that have passed these laws, as much as 40% in Connecticut after they passed such a law. And we also see reductions in suicide because of the sort of built-in waiting period and ability to perhaps catch mental health records that aren't reported to the national level. We see reductions in suicide as well. So that's one policy that is really about the people that want to have guns and less about, you know, the guns themselves.
Right,
again, I mentioned earlier extreme risk protection orders. They've been shown to be effective in Connecticut at reducing suicide among individuals who have been deemed to be at a high risk and had their firearms temporarily removed. And at a minimum, expanding background checks to all sales. So right now we have a system in which people can choose to go to a federally licensed firearm dealer, or if not, they can go to a private seller. And so closing that that loophole that allows individuals to purchase from a private seller without undergoing a background check would help make it harder for prohibited people to obtain firearms.
And what about in Philadelphia? And I'm interested, since, Scott, you work with young people in this city, what would reduce the level of gun violence in Philadelphia?
Well, one of the challenges that we have in Philadelphia, unlike some of the places that Cass has talked about, is the relative ease with which people can acquire guns, and the fact that, you know, in Philadelphia and the rest of Pennsylvania, in order to become to have a concealed carry permit, it's rather simple. You merely have to prove that you're not a fugitive or that you don't have a history of forced hospitalization for mental illness. And then you just have to provide two pieces of mail that show that you live at that residence, and you have to bring a passport ID, and you have to bring a $20 money order, not a $25 money order, but a $20 money order. And it's really that simple to get a license to carry. There's no requirement for you to demonstrate, you know, the skill with that weapon. And as a result, I believe I read that we have about 40,000 active concealed carry permits in the city. And if you're wondering what that has to do with how, you know, the violence that we're seeing in the street, we are also a city that has a lot of car break-ins. And what you end up finding is that a lot of the people that bring guns into the city, they leave them in their car. Those cars get broken into, those guns get stolen, and those guns find their way into the street. I think that we have to be a little more serious about the people to whom we allow to have concealed carry permits. And that's one of the challenges that we face.
What about the people that are using guns illegally? I mean, they're getting them. Maybe it's a stolen gun, or maybe it's sold on a street corner, and they don't go through any kind of permitting.
Right. And, you know, every gun that is in the streets originated with a gun manufacturer. And one of the challenges that we have is being able to figure out where those guns came from. We don't have a national registry for guns. There's no way to kind of trace it back to exactly where these guns came from. I think that would certainly be helpful if we had some way of identifying the source of these weapons. One of the other things that poses a problem is straw purchasing, so that, you know, an individual who would otherwise be prohibited because of a violent or a felonious past can simply find somebody else to go in and purchase that gun. And if that individual's gun, the person who bought the gun, has that gun traced back to them, they merely have to say, I didn't realize that gun had been stolen out of my home, or it was stolen, I just failed to report it. It's rare that people are being prosecuted for failing to report a lost or stolen gun.
At this listening,
I would just say the permitting process that I described earlier, and I mentioned reductions in homicide and suicide. We actually also see reductions in diversions of guns to criminals. So it's harder in states that have permit to purchase laws for criminals to acquire new firearms mm-hmm. in the state that they're in. They have to get guns from across state lines. So that's one piece. And as Scott said, mandatory loss and theft reporting also is an important component, because if there is some mechanism that requires you to say that your gun was lost or stolen that reduces the likelihood, as Scott was describing, that someone could just claim that, you know, while they sold it or gave it to someone else, that they, you know, they can't make that claim without then being in violation of not having filed a lost or theft report.
Let me raise something that the president said yesterday, and this is, has to do with arming teachers and school personnel. He talked about a coach at Stoneman Douglas, and he said here that coach was very brave, saved a lot of lives, I suspect. But if he had had a firearm, he wouldn't have had to run. He would have shot, and that would have been the end of it. Student survivor of the Parkland shooting, a young man named Alfonso Calderon, was speaking to Don Lemon last night following the CNN town meeting about what the president proposed.
Let me just tell you something that the president said. He talked about the possibility of arming some teachers. I'm sure you heard about that at the town hall. Do you feel that idea would that make you feel safer?
That's a terrible idea. I don't know if Donald Trump has ever been to a public high school, but as far as I'm aware, teachers are meant to be educators. They are meant to teach young minds how to work in the real world. They are not meant to know how to carry AR-15s. They are not meant to know how to put on Kevlar vests for the other students or for themselves. This is not what we stand for. We stand for small policy changes and maybe possibly big ones in the future. Because right now, I'm pretty sick of having to talk about teachers being armed. Because that is not even a possibility in my mind. I would never want to see my teachers have to do that, and neither do they want to do that.
And Scott, people that I've heard besides the president who support this, and I know the NRA supports this as well, saying, you know, that you can have a gun and be a good shot in a rampage shooting in a high school. I know with police officers, this is their job. Mm-hmm. Their accuracy is
incredibly low.
Isn't like 30% or
about
30%. 30% when the perpetrator is not shooting at them, and as low as 18% when they're engaged in an active gun battle. And these are trained people. And I always make the argument, and I have people all the time make this suggestion that we should arm teachers. And I explain that that would suggest that your average teacher has all of the skills to be a SWAT team member. And I would argue that there are very different kinds of folks that both go into teaching and that go into becoming, you know, even among police, there's a rare group of police who then will become SWAT team members to be engaged in this kind of thing. But I think there's a level of magical thinking that goes on with gun ownership, this idea that they solve all problems. And then it's really one of the efforts that I work toward is trying to tell the truth about guns. But this idea that you can simply put a gun in the hand of your average teacher and they'll be able to conduct themselves appropriately in the middle of a gunfight in a classroom full of children is just silly.
Do you agree?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, the training that's required to be able to calmly and effectively respond to an active shooter incident, like you think about the training and practice required to become a surgeon, right? You're not going to ask a teacher to suddenly perform life-saving surgery on a, you know, without the necessary training. So why is it that we're expecting them to be able to arm themselves and shoot? I shoot regularly. I have concealed carry permits because I wanted to go through the training, but I do not feel like I have the level of, you know, sort of ability that I could safely use a firearm in a crisis situation. My concern is that I would hit a bystander or some other innocent person, and my concern with arming teachers is that exact thing is going to happen. If, God forbid, there is an event and a teacher pulls out a weapon to try to defend his students, and then he ends up unintentionally shooting a student. Yeah. And then where do we end up? I think guns in schools are just, it's just bad. It's a bad idea.
And in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo shooting
in Paris,
there was a gun rights group that decided that they were going to demonstrate the fact that a gun would have saved lives, and they brought in cameras and they set it up. And even when they realized that somebody would be barging through that door, they were unable to stop this massacre. So I think it's a lot easier than it's a lot harder than we think. We think it's a lot easier than it actually is.
Let me read a bunch. Yeah, go ahead, Cass. And then I do want to read some comments. We got a lot of them here, but go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say there's an FBI analysis of active shooter incidents, and unarmed civilians are 20 times more likely to stop an active shooter event than an armed civilian. So I think we we expect that giving a firearm to someone is suddenly going to turn them into a hero that is capable of doing these great things. And I don't think that matches with the data.
Let me read some comments. One from Kathleen. Gun collectors and hunters own nearly all assault rifles in the United States. People with the potential to commit mass murder own the rest. I have a hard time understanding why the hobbies of some are more important than protecting human life. Ban assault weapons. Get a new hobby. Susan emailed, I keep hearing about gun rights. What about the responsibilities that go along with them? Why aren't gun owners held responsible when their weapons are used by minors or someone other than those who own them? I wager shooting will drop when people are held responsible. If your guests are more indicative of the majority of gun owners, sensible, why does the NRA seem to only reflect the extreme fringe voices of their membership? And that's an interesting question. And perhaps, Cass, I can toss that back to you, because some of the surveys that I've read of NRA members, many of them are in support of what would be, I think, described as sensible gun control or gun safety measures.
Absolutely. Our own research shows that there's very little difference between gun owners and non-gun owners and Democrats and Republicans with regard to supporting sort of these common sense policies, background checks for all sales, for example. The problem is gun manufacturers also support, provide money for the NRA, and the NRA has a vested interest in then promoting the use and sale of firearms, and the easiest way they've found to do that is to promote people's fear. And so they're stoking these fear-based arguments that encourage people to go out and acquire more firearms and to vote for policies or vote for politicians that will allow them to exercise those rights. And even though the NRA, I think the most recent estimate is they have about 5 million members, and many of those are lifetime members, they don't reflect the sort of larger voice. And so one thing we're trying to think about at our center is how do we activate this very large moderate group of gun owners to have the same sort of depth and drive and passion and become single issue voters. We haven't yet figured that out, but again, I'm seeing some different responses to this shooting that I hope will demonstrate a trend towards that change.
And we're almost out of time here, Scott. I'll toss the last question to you. So we talked about whether this is a moment or not. What will you be looking for?
Well, what I want to see is what this looks like 3 weeks and 3 months down the line, and to see if this group of individuals in Florida is able to kind of transfer this message beyond Florida. Again, there were certainly scenes playing out throughout the country where you saw other groups of high school students. If they're able to do that, if they're able to motivate a critical mass of young people to walk out, to stand up, you're going to see a sea change. I think that the more kind of temperate conversation that's happening within the White House and with lawmakers now is a direct result of these young people standing up. And to coin a term that the kids with whom I work would say, it's pretty clear that the president and others are shook. You can certainly hear that in his tone today.
Well, we could go on. They're playing my song, which means we have to end our discussion. My thanks to both of you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Cassandra Crafisi, thank you for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She's assistant professor at the Center for Gun Policy and Research in the Department of Health Policy and Management at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Scott Charles, always a pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times once again.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's Temple University Hospital's Trauma Outreach Coordinator. He directs the Cradle to Grave program. And we appreciate all those comments and calls to Radio Times. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Al Banks, our engineer. Show produced by Debbie Builder, John Aaronson, Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us.